and had awakened something inside her, some creature that stalked through her daily life, looking for any excuse to spring. This creature was predatory, implacable, and it did not want to go back to sleep. Mace stepped forward, reaching out to take her shoulder. Mace never touched her, unless there was a security issue, and Kelsey was so surprised that she stilled immediately, feeling her anger retreat. "Take your jewels off, lady," Mace pleaded. "Let them go. For all the good they've done, it's not worth what's happening to you. I'll hide them away. No one will ever find them. Build your throne, your legacy, on something else." For a moment, Kelsey wondered whether he was right, whether the jewels were the real problem. The dreams, the voices, Lily's inexorable invasion. Some part of Kelsey's own life seemed to have gotten lost en route. The way her guards eyed her now when they thought she wasn't looking. Tentative, suspicious, sometimes even fearful. The feeling of helplessness when she looked in the mirror and found Lily's face staring back at her. Everything had gone bad somehow, and Kelsey wasn't even sure when it had happened. But the sapphires! What Mace asked was impossible. It didn't even matter that the sapphires did nothing anymore, that they seemed to be lifeless. They were hers. And now Kelsey found herself staring a hard truth in the face. She had her own narcotics. They merely took a different form. "No," she finally replied. "You can't ask me for that." She felt his eyes on her, their weight nearly physical. "Are we going to have a problem, Lazarus?"
"I suppose that depends on you, lady. I'm a queen's guard. I'm sworn."
A throat cleared behind Kelsey, and she whirled, furious that anyone dared to interrupt. But it was only Corin, standing at the top of the steps. "We'll continue this at a later time," she told Mace.
"I can hardly wait."
She gave him a sharp glance, feeling her temper trying to awaken again. But then it subsided. It was only Mace, after all. Mace, who always said the true thing that Kelsey didn't want to hear. She put one hand to her temple, which was suddenly throbbing, clamoring for attention. She felt as though her mind was being pulled in two directions, past and future lying opposite each other on a straight track. At one end lay Lily Mayhew and the strange Englishman who had brought them all to the New World, built a colony, and given the kingdom its name. And at the other end was the Mort army, breaking the walls of her city. Kelsey could see each step clearly, the breach of the wall, the black masses pouring in, the orgy of slaughter and violation and brutality that would follow. Men, women, children, no one would be spared. The sack of New London, they would call it, a horror that would decimate the Tierling for generations. How could there be no alternative? Could she destroy the Mort army as she had destroyed Thorn? She could try, but the terrible consequences if she failed. Kelsey turned back to the horizon, and though it was only her imagination, the black cloud seemed closer. Madness beckoned, and Kelsey felt that it would embrace her if she allowed it. A deep, dark nothingness that would wrap her like a cloak and take all dilemmas away. "What is it, Corin?"
"We've had word from the Catarees. They will not offer assistance. Further, the king's offer of marriage is withdrawn."
Kelsey felt a bitter smile stretch her lips. "Is Catan here?"
"No, lady." "Catan's the first ambassador," Mace told her. "The man for happy times and sweet offers. When they want to cut and run, they send some poor bastard who may or may not survive the trip." "The Catarese messenger did leave a present, lady," Corin added.
"What is it?"
"A stone bowl. For fruit."
Kelsey began to giggle. She couldn't help it. Mace was smiling now, too, but it was a tired smile, worlds removed from his normal grin.
"The Catarese are isolationists, lady. This is their way."
"I suppose there will be no good news," Kelsey replied, her laughter subsiding. "It just isn't that kind of day, is it?"
nor that kind of month, lady.
No, I suppose not. Kelsey began to wipe a tear from her cheek, and saw that her hand was bleeding.
Are you all right, lady?
I'm fine. We should arm everyone in the city who's fit to hold a sword.
We don't have the steel.
Wooden swords, then. Anything. Just give them weapons.
To what end?
Morale. People don't like to feel defenseless. And when the refugees come in, I want all the families with children moved to the keep.
There's not enough room.
Then do the best you can, Lazarus. Kelsey rubbed her temples. Lily was calling her, tugging at her mind, but Kelsey didn't want to go back. Didn't want to watch Lily's life play out inside her head. The present was bad enough.
We should get you back inside, lady. You have a fugue coming on.
She turned to him, surprised. How do you know?
Just the look you get. We know the signs now.
When is Penn back? Mace gave her an inscrutable look.
His leave is over tonight, but he likely won't be back until after you fall asleep.
That's fine.
Be careful, lady.
She whipped around, meaning to snap at him. It was none of his business whom she slept with. But she kept quiet. Penn did not belong to her, after all. If he belonged to anyone, it was to Mace.
Lady? Christ God, Corin!
What? Another messenger?
No, lady.
Corin raised his hands.
It's the magician now. He says he must speak to you.
Who?
The magician who performed at your dinner, Bradshaw.
But the man who emerged from the staircase was not the impeccably neat performer Kelsey had seen at dinner that night. Bradshaw had been badly beaten. Both of his eyes were puffed with dark bruising, and there were red scrapes across his cheeks.
Majesty, he panted, I must beg you for asylum.
What?
The Holy Father has placed a price on my head.
You're joking.
I swear to you, Majesty. £100. I've been on the run for days.
I have no love for the Holy Father, Bradshaw, but it seems unlikely that he would place an open bounty on a man's head.
I'm not the only one, Majesty.
The old priest, Father Tyler.
The Holy Father offers a bounty for him as well.
Kelsey felt her stomach sink, a slow roll, as she realized that she had not seen Father Tyler for several days. Arliss and his siege preparations had kept her far too busy to notice, but now she counted backward and found that it had been at least 3 days since Father Tyler had last come to the keep. "Where is he?" she asked Mace.
"I don't know, lady,"
Mace replied, his face troubled.
"This is the first I've heard of this."
"Find him, Lazarus. Find him right now." Mace went to confer with Corin, and Kelsey was left with the magician. Mace had left her unguarded, she realized suddenly, and this was perhaps the truest indication that he knew the real score. Kelsey was in no physical danger from anyone any more. Her guard was only a polite fiction. An idea glimmered at the edges of her mind for a moment, something to do with the mort, but when she reached out to grasp it, the idea was gone, subsumed in worry over Father Tyler. The magician had been able to outrun his pursuers. What could Father Tyler do? He was an old man, with a broken leg. "Does the Holy Father have some prior grievance with you?" she asked the magician.
"No, Majesty, I swear to you. I never saw him before that night at the keep. Word in the gut is that the Holy Father has excommunicated all performers of my trade, but I'm the only one for whom he offers a bounty."
So this was not about Bradshaw. The Holy Father might hate magicians, but the bounty was a slap aimed directly at Kelsey. How much danger are you really in?
Less than another might be without my gift of vanishing, but I can't outrun them forever, Majesty. I'm too well known in the city. I swear to you, I will be of use to you.
Kelsey laughed and gestured over the wall. Look out there, Bradshaw. I have no need of an in-house performer now.
I understand, Majesty.
The magician stared at the ground for a long moment, then squared his shoulders and spoke quietly.
I'm no performer.
What does that mean? Bradshaw leaned closer. If Mace had been nearby, he would never have allowed it. But he was still deep in conference with Corin, and so Bradshaw was able to hunch over Kelsey, hiding her from the rest of the guard. Look. Bradshaw raised his right palm and held it perfectly still. After a moment, the air above his palm began to shimmer, as cobblestones did in high heat. The shimmer solidified into a knife, a silver knife, with an old and intricate handle.
Try it, Majesty.
Kelsey grasped the knife, found it solid in her hand.
They say you have magic, Majesty, in your jewels. But there is other magic in the tear. My family is full of such gifts.
Kelsey snuck another quick look at Mace.
He would not like it, she knew. He distrusted magicians, all of their ilk.
And yet the man had meant no harm that night. Kelsey had hired him to perform. There were larger considerations here, too. The Holy Father might have paid off the nobles of New London, but the truly devout would never tolerate something as prosaic as a bounty from the Arvath.
I will take you in, she told the magician, but the Queen's Wing won't be a safe haven for very long. When the Mort come, you may wish you had simply disappeared for good. Thank you, Majesty. I will take no more of your time.
Bradshaw whirled with his unnatural acrobat's grace and was off toward Mace before Kelsey could tell him that she was not busy.
Far from it, that she had nothing better to do than stare out at the horizon and watch a ghastly destruction play out over and over in her mind.
That cloud on the horizon belonged to her. She was the one who had brought it here. She shivered, sensing again the tickling fingers of Lily's mind, nearly a physical thing, worming its way inside her own. Lily's life was hurtling towards some calamity, and she needed something from Kelsey, something Kelsey could not see yet. And now, Kelsey saw that there was no difference which vision she lived in. Past or future, in either direction lay only terror. She turned back to the horizon, and restarted the count of her own mistakes, preparing to suffer through them again, one at a time. Preparing to scourge.
"Bastards aren't worried about us any more, that's for sure,"
Bermond muttered.
"No real sentries out there, just the hawks."
Hall grunted in agreement, but didn't look up from his helmet. A sword had grazed his chin 2 days before, slicing the helmet's clasp clear off. Hall had rigged a substitute by sewing on an extra piece of leather, but now the fit was imperfect. The helmet kept threatening to slide off his head. Still, it could have been worse. He would have a scar, but his winter beard would easily cover it. The stupid clasp had probably saved his teeth, if not his life. The clasp seemed like something Hall should have kept, a good luck charm to carry in his pockets. But it was lost now, perhaps 3 miles up the Cadell.
"Stop fucking with that thing, Ryan, and have a look."
With a sigh, Hall dropped his helmet and pulled out his spyglass. He hadn't slept in 3 days. The last 2 weeks had been a blur of pitched battles and retreat as the Mort army pushed them inexorably southwest across the Clive and back toward the lower Almont. Sometimes Hall couldn't tell whether he was asleep or awake anymore, whether the war he fought was real or merely taking place inside his own head. The Mort had taken both banks of the Cadell several days ago, and now the river was crossed with several portable footbridges, ingenious mechanisms that Hall could not help admiring, even while he schemed ways to bring them down. The footbridges allowed the Mort to hold not only both sides of the river, but the water itself, to move straight up the riverbed without effectively dividing their forces. The bridges appeared to be made of solid oak reinforced with steel in the center to keep them from snapping under the army's weight, but they disassembled quickly for transport. Someone in Mort Main was a hell of an engineer, and Hall wished he could speak to him for just a few minutes, even now while the world came down around their ears. Hall's spyglass caught and held on a flag on the south side of the Cadell. Most of the Mort camp was either black or a deep storm cloud grey. But this flag was bright scarlet. Hall stood up from his crouch, disregarding the threat of Mort archers, and focused the lens. The red flag was planted on top of a deep crimson tent.
Sir, 10 o'clock on the south side of the river. What? Oh, hell, look at that.
Berman set down his spyglass and rubbed his temples. He hadn't slept in days either. Even the blue plume on his helmet, a sign of rank to which Berman was ridiculously attached, hung limply in the hazy sunlight.
All we need now. Maybe it's not really her, only a ruse by the Mort. You think it's a ruse? No,
Hall replied after a moment's thought.
She's here, come to finish what she started. Morale's hanging by a thread already. This might snap it.
Hall turned his spyglass west toward New London. The Queen's refugee camp sprawled in front of the city, a vast acreage of tents and tarps, and now it was a frenzy of activity as census people evacuated the last occupants into New London. Stone walls ringed the city, a perimeter set just off the edge of the Cadell, some 10 feet high. But these walls had been hastily constructed on soft riverbank ground. They would not stand up to assault. Everything was a holding action. One more day to finish the evacuation, and then Berman would pull the army back to New London, and they would all settle in for siege. A thick cloud of smoke hung over the city. They were slaughtering and roasting all of the animals, curing the meat for the long haul. The army had also been hoarding water, knowing that once the Mort reached the walls, the Cadell would be cut off. Good preparations, but still a holding action. There was only one way for a siege to end.
Still, Mort morale might be weak as well, Bermond mused hopefully. The Mort like their plunder, lad, and we've given them none. I hate to admit it, but the Queen had a good idea with her evacuation. There must be some grumbling going on in their camp by now.
Not enough, Hall replied, and gestured toward the crimson tent.
If they were grumbling, she'd put a stop to it.
He didn't want to mention the Red Queen by name, an old superstition from his childhood on the border, where every child knew that if you spoke of the Red Queen, she might appear. Names made a thing real, far more real than that distant spot of scarlet. And yet, once his men spotted the tent, Hall knew that the fear would sweep through the remainder of the Tyr army like an evil wind. Berman sighed.
How do we keep them off for one more day?
Pull back,
mass at the entrance to the bridge and build a barricade. They have siege towers.
Let them try. We have oil and torches.
You're in fine form today. What did you do? Sneak off to Whore's Alley last night? No. Then what?
I had a dream.
A dream?
Bermond repeated, chuckling.
About what?
About the Queen, Hall replied simply. I dreamed that she lit a great fire that wiped the land clean.
The Mort, the Red Queen, the Wicked. All of the Tyr's enemies were swept away. Never knew you to be a man for portents, Ryan. I'm not. But all the same, it put me in a good mood. You place far too much faith in a naive child.
Hall did not reply. Bermond would never see the Queen as anything but an upstart. But Hall saw something else, something he could not quantify.
They're coming again, Bermond muttered. Put your helmet on. See if you can push them down toward the muddy part of the bank. Their footwork isn't nearly as fearsome as their steel, and they'll have trouble on soft ground.
Hall signalled to the men behind him to get ready. A detachment of Mort had emerged from the camp, spreading out along the north bank of the Cadell. Time and time again they had pushed the Tyr back with flanking manoeuvres. An easy business with overwhelmingly superior numbers. This would be no different. Hall spared a final glance for the refugee camp behind him, the ant-like frenzy of the final stages of the evacuation.
One more day, he thought.
then drew his sword and led his men down the knoll toward the river. Vermund remained on the hilltop. His limp didn't allow him to engage in close combat any more. Hall's men caught him up as he ran, surrounding him on both sides. Blazer right beside him. Blazer had taken a nasty wound to the collarbone on the shores of the Clyde, but the medics had stitched it up, and now Blazer was bellowing as they reached the bottom of the hill and ran into the Mort line. Hall felt the impact of an iron sword against his, all the way down his arm, but the pain was muted, as it always was in dreams. He regarded the assailant across from him, slightly bewildered, wondering for a moment what they were actually fighting about. But muscle memory was a powerful thing. Hall heaved the soldier away and sliced downward, finding the join between wrist and glove. The man shrieked as his hand was nearly severed. "Hawks! Hawks!" The shout had gone up behind Hall on the knoll. He looked up and found at least 10 hawks speeding over his head. Not sentries, these. They cruised the sky, spread equidistant, flying westward in silent formation. Specially trained? But for what? There was no time to ponder it. Another Mort soldier came at him, this one left-handed, and Hall forgot about the hawks as he fought the man off. His helmet fell backward again, off his head, and Hall cursed as he threw it to the ground. Fighting without a helmet was a good way to die, but even death seemed like an acceptable outcome at this point. At least there would be sleep waiting there. Hall jabbed at the Mort, felt his sword clang harmlessly off the man's iron breastplate. The damned Mort armor. A scream came from behind him, but Hall could not turn around, not even when warmth soaked the back of his neck. Someone launched into the Mort from the side, knocking him to the ground. Blazer, grappling with the soldier for a moment before clubbing him across the face. When the man lay still, Blazer got up and grabbed Hall's arm, pulling him back toward the tier line.
"What is it? A retreat? Come, sir! The general!"
They pushed their way back through, knocking aside several Mort along the way. Hall moved along in a dream. Everything seemed muted somehow. The sunlight, the sounds of battle, the stench, even the screams of the dying. But the waters of the Cadell were clear and sharp, a bright and sparkling red. Atop the knoll ahead, a group of soldiers were clustered, their faces grave. Something about this tableau shook Hall awake for the first time in days, and he began to run, Blazer at his side, heedless of the battle at the bottom of the hill. Berman lay face down in a heap. No one had dared touch him, so Hall squatted down and rolled him over. A collective groan went up from the assembled men. Berman's throat had been torn out, leaving only shreds of flesh that dangled on either side of his neck. His chest had been protected by his armor, but all four of his limbs had been shredded to pieces. His left arm was barely attached at the shoulder. His eyes gazed blankly at the sky from a face wet with blood. A few feet away, in the grass, Hall spotted Berman's helmet with its ridiculous blue plume. A silly affectation, that helmet, but Berman had loved it, loved riding the Tierling with the plume waving jauntily in the breeze. A general for peace, not wartime. And Hall felt his throat tighten as he closed Berman's eyes.
"Sir, we're losing ground."
Hall straightened and saw that the tier line was indeed weakening. At several points the Mort had pushed the tier neatly inward like a pin in a cushion. Hall stared at the men around him, Blazer and Caffrey, Colonel Griffin, a young major whose name he didn't know, several infantry, feeling at a loss. Promotion of a general required a formal procedure, approval by the Queen, a ceremony. Hall had stood right beside Berman years ago when Queen Alyssa had invested him with command. At this moment the Queen was miles away, but when Hall looked around, he saw that all of them, even Griffin, were looking to him, waiting for orders. Queen or no, he was the general now.
"Caffrey, fall back to the next knoll."
Major Caffrey took off in a dead sprint down the hill.
"You, Griffin, pull the remainder of your battalion back and head for New London. Take the leftover material from the deserted areas of the refugee camp and barricade the bridge. A barricade of old furniture and tents won't hold up for long.
But it has to. Ask the Queen for extra lumber if you need to, but get it done. We'll meet you there as soon as the evacuation's complete.
Griffin turned and strode away. Hall returned his attention to the battlefield and saw that the tier had already begun to retreat, inching up the gentle slope at the bottom of the knoll. He looked down at Berman's corpse and felt sorrow and exhaustion heave up inside him, but there was no time for either. The mort was slowly creeping up the slope, accelerating the retreat. A deep voice bellowed orders behind the mort line, and Hall knew somehow that it was General Ducarte, close to the battle now. Ducarte wasn't one to hang back and keep his hands clean. He had come to see blood.
You! Hall pointed to the two infantrymen.
Go with Griffin. Take the general's body back to New London.
They lifted Berman's body and carried it down the other side of the knoll, toward the horses. Hall followed their passage for a moment, then lifted his eyes to the refugee camp. Defenseless people. An entire city.
One more day, he thought, watching the mort mass at the weakest point of the tier line and charge, swords and freshly polished armour gleaming in the sunlight. They went through the tier easily, breaking the line, even as Hall's soldiers scrambled to get back up the hill. Tier soldiers swarmed in, bolstering the gap, but the damage was done. There was a hole in Hall's formations now, and they would have no time to regroup. The mort pressed their advantage, massing at the weak point, forcing the tier to fall backward and accommodate them. Bermond was dead, but Hall could still feel him somewhere, on the next hill perhaps, watching and evaluating, waiting to see what Hall would do next. The sun broke through the clouds, and Hall drew his sword, relieved to find new life in the muscles of his arm, to find himself more awake than he had been in a long time. The mort tore through the tier line, a black mass that could not be defeated. And General Hall charged down the hill to meet them.
Chapter 11. Blue Horizon. In the decade before the crossing, the American security apparatus took thousands of alleged separatists into custody. The sheer number of detainees convinced the American government, as well as the public, that security was winning the war on domestic terrorism. But this single-minded focus on demonstrable results also blinded the government to the real issue, an enormous fault beneath the American surface, unseen, that was finally beginning to crack. The Dark Knight of America, Glee Delamere. Dorian was gone. Lily stood in the doorway of her nursery, blinking. Dorian was gone, and so were the medical supplies, the extra clothes that Lily had given her. The nursery was still, as always, full of tiny dust motes that floated in the late morning sun. No one would know that Dorian had ever been there. Of course Lily hadn't expected her to say goodbye, but she had thought there would be more time. Now William Tier had come in the night and taken Dorian away. Lily turned and walked back down the hall. All of her pleasure in the morning suddenly evaporated. What was she supposed to do now? She was supposed to play bridge later with Michelle and Christine and Jessa. But she saw now that she would have to call that off. There was no way she could sit there at the table with the three of them, gossiping and drinking whatever cocktail Christine favoured this week. Something had shifted, and now there was no way for Lily to return to the world of small things. 2 days later, the news sites announced that simultaneous terrorist attacks had taken place in Boston and Dearborn, Virginia. The terrorists in Boston had broken into one of Dow's warehouse facilities and stolen medical equipment and drugs, nearly $50 million worth, a huge coup that was splashed all over the top of every website. But the attack in Virginia, though less spectacular, was more interesting to Lily because it made no sense. Some 10 or 12 armed guerrillas had broken into a billionaire's Dearborn horse farm and stolen most of his breeding stock. The guerrillas came prepared, with their own trailers for the horses, but they took nothing except the animals and some equipment for their care.
Horses? Lily was baffled. No one actually used horses for anything anymore, not even farming. They were a rich man's vice, only valuable for harness racing and the gambling that went with it. Lily wondered briefly if the tall Englishman was crazy, for she was certain somehow that this was Tyr's work. But that wasn't the impression she had received. Rather, the entire thing seemed like a puzzle, one that was missing several pieces. Horses and medical equipment stolen, jet facilities destroyed. Each day, Lily moved these pieces around a board in her mind, trying to understand. She felt sure that if she could only fit them together, assemble the puzzle, then it would somehow clarify everything, show her the Englishman's real plan, the clear outlines of the better world. 3 days after the Virginia attack, Lily was back in the hospital. It started very simply. A shirt Greg wanted to wear happened to be at the dry cleaners, and when Lily couldn't produce the shirt, Greg slammed her fingers in the bedroom door. It didn't even hurt at first. There was only the door, held tight against her hand so that no sensation travelled. But when Greg opened the door a few seconds later, the pain came roaring in, and when Lily screamed, Greg did something he had never done before, and punched her twice in the face. On the second shot, Lily felt her nose break, a thin, crisp snap, like stepping on a twig in winter. Greg was already late for his meeting, and so it was Jonathan who took Lily to the emergency room. He said nothing, but she could see his set jaw and narrowed eyes in the rear-view mirror.
Whom did he disapprove of?
Both of them. She hadn't spoken to Jonathan since that night in the living room. He was clearly determined to pretend that it had never happened, so Lily did the same. Sometimes she wished that she could talk to him about it, but Jonathan's reserve kept her from opening the discussion. She concentrated on her nose instead, working hard to keep blood from dripping to the seats. It turned out that Lily had two broken fingers in addition to the broken nose, and she could only stare groggily around the brightly lit room as Jonathan responded to the doctor's questions. When it was time to repair her nose, they knocked her out. She spent the night in the hospital, in the charge of two nurses, and when she woke up and heard their voices, kind and mothering, Lily wished that she could stay there forever. There was pain in the hospital and sickness, but it was a safe place. Greg had said it wouldn't happen again, but he had been lying. Several times since that day at the country club, Lily had woken up with Greg's fingers inside her, shoving painfully, almost scraping. Broken bones were bad, but that was infinitely worse. And the hospital felt so safe compared to home. 5 days later, the power went out all over New England. It was a brief outage, only 20 minutes, and there was no real damage done, except for a few traffic accidents. But still the incident caused a flurry of panic in Washington and on the stock exchanges, because such an outage was supposed to be impossible. In a world where everything was run by computers, safeguarded and backed up 8 ways to Sunday, the system wasn't supposed to have room for failure. Greg said that the hardware had been defective, but Lily wondered. She thought of Dorian, of how a woman without a tag had been able to get through security at a naval base. She thought of the thousands of soldiers, like Jonathan, who had come back from serving in Saudi Arabia, to find that there were no jobs, no market for their skills. And now she began to wonder, how many separatists were there, really? The news site spoke of the Blue Horizon contemptuously, describing the cell as a few disorganized, dissatisfied groups of mentally unstable individuals. But the evidence didn't bear that out. Lily thought of Arnie Welch, the security lieutenant, who had once admitted, over too many drinks, that the terrorists were both efficient and organized. William Tyr had said that there were ways through every barrier, and the question swirled in Lily's head, maddening. Just how big was the Blue Horizon? Did they all answer to Tyr? What was the better world? The next weekend, Greg had Arnie Welch over to dinner, along with two of Arnie's underlings.
Greg always invited Arnie on the rare occasions when he was in town. They'd been fraternity brothers at Yale. Greg said it was useful to be friends with a security lieutenant, and even Lily saw the sense in that. But this time, when Arnie walked through the door, Lily didn't see Greg's parking tickets, or a quick travel visa for vacations, or even the security helicopters that Arnie would sometimes loan as a favor when business was slow. Instead, she saw Maddie being hustled out the school doors, the last flash of her blonde pigtails, a picture so clear that Lily swayed momentarily on the threshold, and when Arnie tried to put an arm around her shoulders, she ducked away toward the kitchen. For once, Arnie didn't drink during dinner, and he glared at his two flunkies when they showed signs of reaching for the whiskey. Greg heckled him about it, but Arnie merely shrugged, saying, "I can't afford a hangover tomorrow." Lily was just as happy to have Arnie stay sober. He got pretty handsy when he drank, once he'd actually tried to worm his hand between her legs at the table. Lily could never tell whether Greg noticed these advances. As possessive as he had become, he seemed to have achieved a level of deliberate blindness when someone was in a position to be useful to him. But Lily had seated Arnie on the far side of the table, just in case. Although her nose was almost back to normal, Lily still had noticeable bruising under her right eye, but she wasn't surprised when Arnie didn't ask about it. She found that she could barely eat. Her healing fingers, both of them still encased in temporary splints, made it hard to manipulate the knife and fork. But that wasn't really the problem. She had spent most of her married life telling lies, but ever since Dorian toppled over the back wall, there had been a shift in the foundation, and it was becoming harder to dissemble, harder to force each individual lie out. She was afraid of her husband, but the fear was less important now. She sensed a wider world out there, a world not run by people like Greg, and sometimes, even though she understood nothing, she knew exactly what Dorian meant. It was so close, she could almost touch it. "Pigs," she thought, watching Greg and the military men snort and chuckle and snuffle their food. "Pigs, all of you. You have no idea about the better world." Lily didn't understand the better world either, true, but she thought she was beginning to at least see the outline now. "No poverty and no greed," Tyr had said. "Kindness is everything." People like Greg would be entirely irrelevant. Yesterday he had told her that he'd made contact with an in vitro doctor. They would go on Monday. Lily couldn't imagine what her life would look like on Tuesday. She had her doubts that Arnie could really stay sober throughout dinner. Even among Greg's normal set of dinner invitees, Arnie was a consummate booze hound. The whiskey bottle sat on the table right in front of him, Greg's idea of a good joke during the entire meal. But somehow, Arnie ignored the bottle, sticking strictly to water. He was nervous and jumpy, constantly checking his watch. His two underlings weren't much better, though they still found time to nudge each other and grin at Lily during the meal. She was used to this kind of thing and ignored their comments, even when she heard herself referred to as a nice piece of snatch.
"What's got you so twitchy?" Greg finally asked Arnie. "Are you on drugs?"
Arnie shook his head.
"Slow and sober. I have a long day tomorrow, that's all." "Doing what?" "It's classified. I'm cleared."
Arnie looked uncertainly across the table at Lily.
"She's not cleared." "Oh, fuck her. She's not going to tell anyone."
Greg turned to Lily with narrowed eyes.
"Are you?"
She shook her head automatically, keeping her eyes on her plate.
"So come on, man, give,"
Greg begged, and Lily suddenly saw something she had never seen before. Greg was jealous of the military men across the table. Greg worked for several defense contractors, yes, but his was a desk job. Arnie was trained to fire weapons, to interrogate, to kill people. And Greg thought that made Arnie a better man.
"Tell us what you've been up to."
Still, Arnie hesitated, and Lily felt a tiny alarm go off inside. Clearance or not, Arnie was always telling Greg things he shouldn't, and it usually didn't take much alcohol to make it happen. She kept her eyes on her plate, trying to make herself as invisible as possible, waiting for him to speak. But after a few moments, Arnie merely shook his head again. "Sorry, man, no, it's too big, and your wife's not cleared." "Fine! Come on upstairs, we'll talk in my study." "You two go down and wait in the car," Arnie told his two flunkies, then wiped his mouth and threw his napkin on the table. "Thanks, Lily. That was great." She nodded and smiled mechanically, wondering if Arnie had noticed the splints on her knuckles. The flunkies left, and Greg and Arnie disappeared upstairs. Lily stared at her plate for a moment, considering, then grabbed the edge of the table with her uninjured hand and levered herself up. Leaving the dirty dishes scattered all over the table, she hurried through the kitchen and into the small guardhouse that housed their surveillance equipment. Jonathan was supposed to be on duty tonight, but Lily was hardly surprised to find the alcove empty. She wondered how many nights the house had been left unguarded while Jonathan was out running errands for the Blue Horizon. Tapping at the screen, Lily brought up Greg's study, a dark, mahogany-filled room that tried too hard to be masculine. The walls were panelled with bookshelves, but they held no books, only Greg's old football trophies and pictures of Greg and Lily with important people at various events. The walls were covered with plaques. Greg liked to show off his awards. Arnie was sitting in one of the big armchairs in front of Greg's desk, and Greg was behind the desk with his leather executive chair tilted back. Both of them were smoking cigars, and the haze had drifted up toward the camera, making Greg's features indistinct. "The building blew and collapsed," Arnie said, "just like it was supposed to. They clearly had an escape plan, but it got botched somehow. I've got to hand it to Langer. Much as I hate that bastard, he pulled off a pretty good trick. It looked like all of them died, but Langer managed to grab one alive, some guy named Gooden. They've been working on him for the past 4 days, and he finally broke last night." "What broke him?" Greg asked, his voice crawling with eagerness, and Lily closed her eyes. How long would it have taken them to break Maddie? Forever, Lily thought. But deep down, she knew that wasn't true. She wiped her forehead, and her hand came away wet. Arnie looked uncomfortable, too. "I'm off duty now, man. I don't want to talk about that shit." "Yeah, I suppose not," Greg replied grudgingly. "So what did he say?" "He wasn't high up or anything, but he gave us a lot." Arnie's face became animated again. "The leader of the Blue Horizon is some guy who calls himself Tyr. A Brit, if you can believe it." "I do believe it. The UK and their fucking socialist experiment." "Well, this Tyr is apparently the big money. The separatists think he's some kind of god. Blue Horizon sprang up out of the old Occupy movements, but you know they didn't know what they were doing. This Tyr, though, he's a trained guerrilla. That's why they've been such a pain in the ass the last few years." Arnie lowered his voice, and Lily thumbed the volume control on the screen. "They're holed up in an abandoned warehouse down on Conley Terminal." "Where's that?" "Port of Boston. I've spent all day looking at maps. That warehouse has been condemned for at least 10 years, but Frewell's boys took all the money Boston was supposed to use for a new container facility and put it into some god crap or another, so all the containers have just been standing there. Gooden says they're using the warehouse as a headquarters. We're going in at dawn." Lily stared at the screen, frozen. "They put Langer in charge of the whole thing. It's his baby now, and he wants prisoners. We have to surround the terminal on land and water, which is no easy trick. Lots of boats and lots of men. My division is supposed to provide a secondary perimeter tomorrow morning." Arnie sighed and stubbed out the remains of his cigar. "So? No booze. Want to play some poker? I've got a game downtown." "Can't, really. I have to be in Boston in 2 hours. My copter's waiting down at the pad." Greg nodded, though his lip had pushed out in that little pout that Lily had come to know so well lately. "Fine.
I'll walk you out.
Lily shut off the screen and hurried back into the dining room where she set the washer to begin clearing plates. When Greg and Arnie's voices had disappeared out the front door, she dug her phone from her purse and called Jonathan, but he didn't pick up. There was only his dry, deep voice, a generic greeting. Lily couldn't leave him a real message. Her calls were monitored. Trying to keep the panic from her voice, she demanded that he call her back immediately. But she couldn't escape the feeling that wherever Jonathan was, he wouldn't get back to her in time. She could see it now, the darkened warehouse, Dorian inside with William Tear. Dorian had said that she wasn't going back into custody, not ever again. The Boston waterfront, the blue horizon. Lily closed her eyes and saw the tiny group of wooden houses beside the blue river, bathed in sun.
I have to do something.
And what can you do, Lil? Maddie asked, her voice jeering. You've never had the courage to do anything in your entire life.
I did, Lily insisted. When Dorian fell into the backyard, I did.
But deep down, she knew that Maddie was right. Dorian had been a low-risk decision. Almost a game, insulated in the relatively safe environment of the nursery. What Lily was contemplating now was something else entirely. She formulated a plan, rejected it, formulated another, rejected that, formulated a third, and examined it, turning it over for flaws. It was a stupid plan, no doubt. It would probably get her arrested, maybe even killed. But she had to do something. If the better world was real, it was also unutterably fragile. And without Tear, there would be nothing.
Arnie's gone.
Lily focused on the window again and found Greg reflected behind her, though she could not read his expression in the glass. She said nothing, looking ahead now toward Boston. There was no place for Greg in that journey. He would only get in her way.
Are you excited, Lil?
About what?
About Monday.
Lily's hand clenched on the handle of a pot, and for a moment she very nearly turned and flung the pot at his head. But her mind cautioned patience. Her aim might not be good enough. Greg had 6 inches and nearly 100 pounds on her. She would have one shot only, and she could not afford to miss. She cast along the counter, and her gaze fixed on a large, heavy picture frame, nearly a foot tall, that stood on the windowsill. Photos of their wedding day flashed endlessly over the screen in sparkling pixels. Lily saw herself, only 22 years old, covered in yards of white satin, getting ready to cut an enormous tiered cake. Even though her hair was beginning to come down from its elaborate coiffure, and Greg's wretched father stood beside her, she was laughing. God, what happened? Greg took a few steps forward, so close now that Lily could feel his breath on the back of her neck. She reached out to touch the picture frame, grasping its edge in her good hand.
Lil.
If he tries to fuck me now, she thought, I will go insane. It will be very easy. I'll just float off, and then none of this will matter. Not William Tear, or the blue horizon, or a warehouse down on the Boston port. None of it.
Lil. Are you excited?
His hand settled on her shoulder and Lily whipped around, bringing the frame with her, swinging its sidearm as she would a tennis racket at the club. The frame crunched into the side of Greg's head, tiny plastic shards flying everywhere, peppering Lily's hand and arm. And Greg fell sideways, banging his head on the marble counter on the way down, a deep thunk. Lily raised the frame again, ready. But Greg was down for the count, sprawled on his side on the kitchen floor. After a moment, blood began to trickle down his face from his scalp, tiny red dots dripping onto the white tile.
"Well, that's done," Lily whispered, unsure who she was talking to. She thought about checking Greg's pulse, but couldn't bring herself to touch him.
Moving slowly, as if in a dream, she went upstairs to their bedroom. She pulled out her oldest jeans, the ones she never wore when Greg was around, and a faded black T-shirt. These clothes were still nicer than anything poor people would wear outside the wall, but they were better than nothing and might offer some camouflage. She covered them with a beaten leather jacket she'd had since she was 15, a remnant of better times that Lily refused to give away. The Mercedes was an automatic. After a moment's thought, Lily removed her splints and left them on the dresser. She tapped at the wall screen, examining maps of the port of Boston while she dressed. Conley Terminal was a big container facility down near Castle Island, tucked into one of the thousand inlets that seemed to make up the Massachusetts coastline. Public roads, it would have to be. Highway 84 to the Mass Turnpike. The private roads would be full of security checkpoints, particularly at night. And when they scanned her chip and found out that she had left her husband behind, it would raise more questions. Lily would have a better chance on public roads, if she even managed to get outside the New Canaan Wall at all. After a bit more searching, she found that condemned property was the province of the Department of the Interior. There were two condemned buildings located on Conley Terminal. Only one looked like a warehouse, but Lily mapped each location carefully and sent the maps onto the Mercedes. Belatedly, she realized that these searches were probably going to trip an alarm somewhere at security, and she had a quick moment of panic before she realized how small a problem that really was, with her husband lying bleeding on the kitchen floor. Even if Greg wasn't dead, women had been executed for less. Lily went downstairs and grabbed the small code key with the Mercedes emblem off the hook on the wall. The Mercedes was their third car, the fancy one for emergencies or important visitors. When she held the key up to the light, she found that her hands were shaking. Her driver's license was still valid, but she hadn't driven a car since she was 18. "Like riding a bike," she whispered. "Just like riding a bike, that's all." She spared a final glance at Greg, who still lay sprawled in the same position on the kitchen floor. Blood had begun to pool beneath his right ear now, but he was still breathing. And for a moment, Lily wondered at her own coldness, until she isolated its source. It didn't really matter whether Greg lived or died, or whether she did herself, only that she got to Boston. The better world, the small village beside the river, these were the things which mattered, and they burned inside Lily's head, searing through the fear, lifting her up. She turned and headed down the hallway toward the garage. No one had driven the Mercedes in a while, but it didn't seem any worse for disuse. Jonathan must have been taking care of it. He liked tinkering with cars, kept the BMW and Lexus in good working order. The Mercedes had a full tank, and its headlights cut easily through the night as Lily turned off Willow Avenue and onto the checkpoint road. Ahead of her, the wall loomed, 20 feet of solid steel polymer, topped with laser edging, blocking off the horizon. Something inside Lily seemed to freeze at the sight, and a low, panicked voice began to babble inside her. The voice of her marriage, Lily realized now, its tone craven and helpless. "You'll never make it through, not in a million years. And when they find Greg..." "Shut up," Lily whispered. Her voice shook in the darkness of the car. The checkpoint appeared out of the fog, a 15-foot break in the wall, lit by bright fluorescent lamps. A small guardhouse, also walled in steel, stood off to the left, and as Lily approached, two guards in security uniforms emerged. Each of them carried a gun, the small laser pistols that security seemed to favor these days. Greg had a gun, Lily suddenly remembered, a tiny thing that he kept in his study. She could have grabbed it, and this made her wonder what else she had forgotten. But it was too late. "Evening, ma'am," the first guard said as she lowered the window. He squinted at her for a moment, then smiled wide. "It's Mrs. Mayhew, isn't it?"
"Yes, John. How are you tonight?"
"Fine, ma'am. Where are you heading?"
"Into the city, to see friends."
"All by yourself at this hour? Where's that black bodyguard of yours?"
"He had to run an errand for my husband."
"Just a moment." He walked around the hood and disappeared back into the guardhouse. The other guard remained on the right side of the hood, a dark silhouette against the fluorescent lamps. Lily kept a pleasant smile on her face, but her fingers had clamped on the steering wheel. The guard had gone to call Greg, and now her mind produced a clear picture. The kitchen, Greg lying there motionless. But his phone rang on and on. The muscles in her thighs were shaking. Outside the bright circle of fluorescence that bathed the car, everything was pitch black.
"Ma'am."
Lily jumped. The guard had silently reappeared at the other window.
"We're not getting any reply from your husband, ma'am."
"He's ill," she replied. "That's why he's not coming with me."
The guard consulted a tiny handheld, and Lily knew that he was scrolling through the details of her life. Greg's position, the fact they were not under surveillance, would weigh in Lily's favor. Lily had never been in trouble, and that would help too. Maddie would be in there, certainly, but so would the information that Lily had been instrumental in turning Maddie in.
"Does your husband always let you go into the city at night by yourself?"
"No. This is the first time."
The guard stood staring down at her, and Lily had the disturbing certainty that his eyes were crawling, even though her breasts were encased in the thick leather jacket. But she kept the smile plastered on, and after a moment the guard raised something black and gleaming. For one panicked moment, Lily thought it was a gun, but then she saw that it was only a scanner. She offered her shoulder and waited for the scan to register with a soft beep. The guard waved Lily forward, and she depressed the gas pedal. Too hard, for the Mercedes leapt forward with a growl. She stomped on the brake, gave an apologetic smile out the open window.
"I haven't driven in a while."
"Well, be careful, ma'am. Stay off the public roads. And don't open your door for any strangers."
"I won't. Have a good night."
Lily pressed the gas again, gently this time, and rolled the car forward, out of the bright circle of light. When Lily was in the car, Jonathan used the private highway, but there had been a few times when the highway was down, blocked by debris dragged onto the roadway or sabotaged by explosives. Even security couldn't repair a badly damaged highway in less than a week, and at such times, Jonathan always turned onto a small back road a few miles outside the wall, a dirt track that headed north for a few minutes through the woods before it joined with Highway 84. No matter how hard security worked to keep the public off the private roadways, they always found a way through, cutting new paths through the woods and digging tunnels beneath fences. This idea, which would have alarmed Lily a few weeks ago, now seemed oddly comforting. Jonathan's back road might have allowed William Tyr to get close to New Canaan before slipping over the wall, might have allowed Dorian to evade security as she fled from the base. It took Lily several U-turns before she spotted the small break in the undergrowth. When she guided the car through, she could hear the scrape of brambles along the paint.
"The better world," she whispered,
as she guided the Mercedes forward through the woods, feeling the sharp thump of rocks beneath the tires. Trees surrounded the car, ghostly white pillars in the glare of the headlights.
"It's out there, so close we can almost touch it."
She kept an eye on the side windows and rear-view mirror. There were probably some people living out here somewhere, though they'd need some serious weaponry to break into this car, which had steel-reinforced windows and was built like a tank. But she saw no one, and after 20 minutes of carefully crawling along, she emerged onto the public highway. Highway 84 was much wider than the private roads, its northern span stretching 6 lanes across. And without the 10-foot walls that bordered most private freeways, it felt very wide, almost limitless in its emptiness. Remnants of a bygone era when everyone could afford cars and gas. Signs on Lily's right advertised the speed limit as 65, but security never bothered to police the public highways anyway, and 65 seemed ridiculously slow, almost like standing still. Lily sped up, then sped up further, easing the car over 85 and up toward 90, finding a pure pleasure in going fast, in watching the miles fly by. Several times she saw the remains of old barricades on the highway shoulder, piles of trash, blown tires and tree branches that had simply been cleared to one side and left for wind and time to disperse. She couldn't fathom the purpose of such barricades, and this, more than anything else, drove home to Lily how little she knew about life outside the wall.